word disease than if shown the word sunshine. These experiments aren't, of course, saying anything about what you feel when you reflect at length on disease. Things happen too fast for conscious reflection to matter. The presentation of the prime, the brief interval, and the presentation of the target word all happen in less than half a second. In fact, the effect holds up even if the prime is presented so briefly that the person isn't consciously aware of seeing it. So what these experiments show is that the word disease, before you call it consciously to mind, already has a negative tag. That's not too surprising. Disease is pretty horrible, and sunshine is pretty glorious. But we see the same dynamic with less obviously evocative things. In fact, the experimenters who surveyed people about their reactions to mundane things, to chains and brooms and garbage cans, to pumpkins and toothbrushes and envelopes, took those same pictures and, using a new group of people, did the priming experiments with them. And it turned out that, yes, pictures that had been judged negatively by the first group, the group asked to consciously evaluate them, tended to be judged negatively by the second group, the group that didn't even realize they were judging them, but by the speed of their reactions to subsequently displayed positive or negative words, rendered implicit judgments. So Zajonc seems to have been right. Human beings are automatic evaluators. We tend to assign adjectives to nouns, whether consciously or unconsciously, explicitly or implicitly. When you think about it, Zajonc almost had to be right. From natural selection's point of view, the whole point of perception is to process information that has relevance to the organism's Darwinian interests, that is, to its chances of getting its genes spread. And organisms register this relevance by assigning positive or negative values to the perceived information. We are designed to judge things and to encode those judgments in feelings. With a species as complicated as ours, it may or may not always be obvious what relevance things have to Darwinian interests. Tape measures, for example, weren't part of the hunter-gatherer landscape in which we evolved, but were designed by natural selection to get satisfaction out of finding the answers to questions. And over time, when I've asked how long something is, tape measures have given me the answer. Maybe that's why I've come to like them. Or maybe it has to do with how using a tape measure makes me feel about myself, a fact that may in turn be grounded in my watching various role models use them when I was a kid. Anyway, to be clear, the claim isn't that everything I feel positively or negatively about will actually have an accordingly positive or negative impact on my chances of spreading my genes. The claim is just that the machinery in my mind that assigns feelings to things was originally designed to maximize genetic proliferation. That it no longer reliably does so is among the absurdities of being a human. The disturbing invisibility of my brother. One more clarification before we get back to emptiness. I'm not claiming that everyone has an effective reaction to everything. The studies I just described, like most studies, reported only aggregate statistics. Buried within that aggregation are particular subjects who reacted neutrally to particular words or pictures. And that's not surprising. After all, even back in our hunter-gatherer days, the landscape featured things that didn't affect our chances of spreading genes one way or the other. So there have always been things that didn't evoke much in the way of feelings. Then again, things like that are things organisms don't pay much attention to in the first place, precisely because they're not important in Darwinian terms. The things organisms do pay attention to, on the other hand, do tend to be of Darwinian significance, and so will tend to evoke feelings. As a result, the perceptual landscape, the landscape of things that we're paying attention to, the things that dominate our consciousness, will tend to be infused, however subtly, with feeling. If there's something you don't have any feelings at all about, you probably won't much notice it in the first place. It may be only a slight exaggeration to say there's no such thing as an immaculate perception. My older brother, after reaching the phase of middle age when women no longer paid much attention to him, said, "It isn't that they think I'm bad-looking. They just don't realize I exist." Exactly. As a heterosexual woman walks down a city block, there are tons of things she could focus on. So the first job of her perceptual apparatus is to filter out things that, with the most cursory, even unconscious appraisal, are seen to not merit extended, conscious appraisal. Sadly, that category of things includes my brother, who, also sadly, was younger than I am now when he attained this status. But if things do merit further appraisal, the appraisal will ultimately be reflected in this woman's feeling. Attractive young male? Less attractive but kind-looking young male? Young male who is intriguingly attractive but looks like he may be insufferably egotistical? Male who is as old as my brother but, unlike my brother, drives a $70,000 car and wears a Rolex watch? All of these kinds of men elicit distinctive feelings. Anything that, by natural selection's lights, is worth paying much attention to at all should, in theory, trigger feelings. And feelings infuse things with essence. At least that's my hypothesis, that the dampened sense of essence some meditators feel has a lot to do with dampened feelings. I once tried out this theory on the person I first heard talk about the formless, Rodney Smith. Rodney is a tall, gangly, gray-haired man with an evangelical air that is unusual among meditation teachers. If you put him behind a Southern Baptist church pulpit, he wouldn't seem out of place, until, at least, he started talking about the formless. In person, Rodney has a direct, no-nonsense style of speaking that can be a real time-saver. I once asked him what the relationship was between the formlessness thing he kept talking about and the Mahayana idea of emptiness. With a bit of a shrug and a dismissive wave of his hand, he said, "Same thing." It was sometime after that exchange, during a longer conversation with him, that I decided to try out my theory that a dialing down of the effective reaction to things is what leads to the experience of emptiness. Rodney had been trying to explain to me what the experience of emptiness is like. On the one hand, I gathered, there's a sense in which things in his perceptual field don't project their independent identities as strongly as they do for most of us. But, Rodney emphasized, you don't lose your ability to identify things. You want to be able to pick up a pair of glasses and put it on and not think that it's a pencil, he said. You don't lose the shapes or colors of things. It's just that the space between them no longer divides. I asked, do you have less strong emotional reactions to things than you might otherwise have? Do you invest them less with kind of emotional content? He replied, that would make sense, wouldn't it, that if things weren't as substantial as you believe them to be, your reaction to things would also simmer. So, that happens. You see, all the states of equanimity come through the realization that things aren't what we thought they were. I felt vindicated, but not completely vindicated. In one sense, Rodney was corroborating my theory. He was saying that, yes, the perception of formlessness or emptiness is correlated with a dampened, affective reaction to things. But his interpretation of this correlation seemed different from mine. Whereas I've been saying that the dampened affect leads to the perception of emptiness, he was saying that it's the other way around. The perception of emptiness dampens the affect. Once you see that the thing you're accustomed to reacting strongly to isn't much of a thing in the first place, it only makes sense to react less strongly. Which one of us is right? Maybe we both are, or at least maybe the difference between what he's saying and what I'm saying isn't ultimately very meaningful. Remember, for starters, that when I talk about our affect being dampened, our feelings being subdued, I'm not saying that's a bad thing. Indeed, I've tried to show why certain feelings are a poor guide to reality, and I've suggested more broadly that the entire infrastructure of feelings should be viewed with a certain suspicion, given that it was built by natural selection, whose ultimate aim isn't to foster clear perceptions and thoughts, but rather to foster the kinds of perceptions and thoughts that have gotten genes spread in the past. So for me to characterize Rodney's experience as a dampening of feeling certainly isn't to say that it couldn't clarify his view of the world. With this in mind, let's look at the two key claims Rodney is making. 1. The apprehension of formlessness or emptiness is a truer perception of things than our ordinary view. And 2. The feelings we normally experience in reaction to these things aren't appropriate in light of the truth about them. These claims are consistent with what I'm saying. Rodney and I are just disagreeing over the mechanics of insight. He says, and here he reflects the orthodox position within Buddhism, that the clarity of vision leads to dampening of feelings. I say that the dampening of feelings leads to the clarity of vision. Indeed, I'd almost go so far as to say the dampening of feelings is the clarity of vision. So finely is affect intertwined with perception, in particular, with the perception of essence. Feelings and stories. There's one other thing that essence seems to be intertwined with. Stories. The stories we are told about things, and the stories we tell ourselves about things, influence how we feel about those things, and presumably, thus shape the essence that we sense in them. If the story behind a tape measure is that it belonged to JFK, that implies a different feeling and a different essence than the story that the tape measure belongs to a plumber. If we think of ourselves as having a successful marriage and wonderful, thriving children, then the sight of our home probably gives off more positive vibes than if we think of ourselves as trapped in an oppressive marriage that has bred ne'er-do-well kids. And so on. This is a major theme of Bloom's, that the stories we tell about things, and thus the beliefs we have about their history and their nature, shape our experience of them, and thus our sense of their essence. One of his favorite examples is a study that involved wine connoisseurs. 40 of them deemed a Bordeaux with a premium label, Grand Cru Classé, worth drinking, but only 12 bestowed that honor on a Bordeaux labeled as mere table wine, vin de table. You've probably guessed the punchline. The two kinds of bottles contained one kind of wine. Wine is an especially clear example of how stories inform our pleasures. That was a very good year. But Bloom thinks that if you look closely enough, every pleasure has a consequential story behind it. He once said to me, "There's no such thing as a simple pleasure. There's no such thing as a pleasure that's untainted by your beliefs about what you're being pleasured by." He used food as an example. If you hand me something and I taste it, part of my knowledge is that it was given to me by someone I trusted, and I would taste it differently than if I found it on the floor or if I paid $1,000 for it. Or take paintings. It's true that you can look at a painting and not know who painted it, and just appreciate it largely based on what it looks like. At the same time, you know it's a painting. In other words, he continued, it's not a natural occurrence of paint splattered on a wall. Somebody made it at some time for display, and that colors things. So too, he said, with the simplest of sensations, an orgasm, drinking water when you're thirsty, stretching, anything. It's always under some sort of description. It's always viewed as an instance of some sort of category. There is always, in other words, an implied narrative. The fact that pleasure is shaped by our sense of essence, and thus by the stories we tell and the beliefs we hold, suggests to Bloom that our pleasures are, in a sense, more profound than we may realize. There is always a depth to pleasure, he has written. But you could look at it the other way around. given that our experience of a bottle of wine can be influenced by the slapping of a fake label on it, you might say that, actually, there is a superficiality to our pleasure, and that a deeper pleasure would come if we could somehow taste the wine itself, unencumbered by beliefs about it that may or may not be true. That is closer to the Buddhist view of the matter. The Man Without Stories. As Exhibit A, I give you the wine-tasting experience of Gary Weber. Weber is a compact, energetic, silver-haired man who has, over the decades, logged thousands and thousands of hours of meditative practice. By Weber's account, all this work has gotten him to a point where his day-to-day consciousness is very different than it used to be, and certainly different from, say, mine. He says his experience involves very little in the way of the self-referential thoughts that dominate the consciousness of most of us. Why did I say that stupid thing yesterday? How can I impress these people tomorrow? Can't wait to eat that chocolate bar, and so on. He calls these the emotionally laden I, me, my thoughts. We'll have to take Weber's word for what it's like to be him, but his claim to have achieved some rare state of consciousness does have a kind of corroboration. He participated in a landmark brain scan study at Yale Medical School that involved a number of highly accomplished, even renowned meditators. It's the study I alluded to in Chapter 4, the one that found the default mode network quieting down during deep meditation. But in Weber's case, the study found something different. His default mode network was quiet, very, very quiet, from the get-go, before he even tried to meditate. Though I'm using Weber to illustrate the Buddhist idea of emptiness, I should concede that he is in some ways not well suited to that purpose. He did study extensively in the Zen Buddhist tradition, but he has also studied in and been influenced by Hindu traditions. And there are parts of Buddhism he rejects, the most important of which, for our purposes, is the term emptiness. He considers the term, at best, misleading. He says he's never known anybody who reached great contemplative depths and reported, "Oh, it's a big void." His own experience of the world is too rich to just call it empty without qualification. I've used words like empty fullness or full emptiness, he says. But whatever you want to call Weber's experience of the world, it sounds very much like what Rodney Smith describes, a world in which things don't have distinctive essences that set them sharply apart from one another. Though Weber, like Smith, can of course tell the difference between a chair and a table and a lamp, and responds appropriately to each, these items don't project independent identities as forcefully as they used to. There's a continuity to things. There's not that differentiation between them and their background, Weber says. They're all one stuff. He sometimes describes this stuff they seem to be made of as a kind of energy, but there's no differentiation in energy or how you feel about them. I once tried to get Weber to elaborate on the nature of the enjoyment he gets from the world and how it differs from the enjoyment I get from the world. I said, "So you're saying, I gather, that there is a kind of pleasure that you can derive via your senses that does not constitute emotional involvement of a problematic kind." "That's correct," he said. But he hastened to add, "You haven't lost your nerve endings. Green tea still tastes like green tea. Red wine still tastes like red wine. You don't lose that. What you lose is the carry forward of that sensation. This is a fantastic glass of wine. This was a great year." But, I pointed out, some people would say that if you don't at least consider it a good glass of wine, if you don't even get emotionally involved enough to like the wine, then there's not much point in living. He answered, "But it's a much cleaner perception. If I'm tasting a glass of wine and I'm trying to impress some restaurant critics or some friend who's a great wine fancier, then I may have a story going. I may have an expectation for how this wine should be and how I should expect it to taste, and so it really blocks my clear, simple perception. So by getting this thought out of the way, this emotional thought out of the way, I have a much higher likelihood of directly perceiving whatever the sensation is. Oddly, I kind of know what he means. When I've been on meditation retreats, sitting in the dining hall, savoring food, I've at times gotten so immersed in the flavors and textures that I wasn't really conscious of what I was eating. What fruit, what vegetable, whatever. I don't recall any story, in even the most basic sense, accompanying the sensation. What I do recall is the sensation feeling very good. Sometimes I think there are two different ways that essence can impede clear perception. In one case, the fantastic glass of wine case, the sense of essence is strong and evokes feelings that wouldn't be part of the essenceless version of the experience. But sometimes the sense of essence is weak, so weak it tends to steer you away from the experience altogether. When I'm on retreat and I get immersed in the texture of a tree's bark, maybe that's because I don't have my usual essence of tree feeling, a feeling so devoid of power that it says basically, it's just another tree, so you can walk right past it and move on to something more important. Through our sense of essence, we give things labels, and one use of labels is to file things away so you don't have to spend time on them. Maybe the reason babies get so immersed in shapes and textures is because they haven't yet developed their filing system, their sense of essence. In other words, they don't yet know what the things surrounding them are. So the world is a wonderland of exploration. And maybe this helps explain how Weber could say that emptiness is actually full. Sometimes not seeing essence lets you get drawn into the richness of things. Another way to put it is to say that in some cases, the story evoked by essence is a minimizing story. That's just a tree or just a piece of celery. But in other cases, the fantastic glass of wine, the tape measure that belonged to JFK, the story is an amplifying story, so loud that it overwhelms intrinsic experience. Maybe essences can be labels that discourage experience altogether, or labels that encourage experience, but in some sense distort it. At any rate, that Weber equates having a strong emotional reaction to something with having a story about it makes sense to me. And so does the idea that jettisoning both the story and the emotion would tend to leave things with a less distinctive essence than they'd otherwise project. But is this really possible? Stripping away the story, the background knowledge, behind your sensory experience? And if so, what is going on in the brain when that happens? Stories and brain scans. A possible answer to the second question came from an experiment involving wine and a brain scanner. The experimenters gave people several different kinds of wine, labeled with several different prices. But two of the choices, the $90 bottle and the $10 bottle, were actually the same wine. People liked the $90 version better. No surprise there. What was interesting was what their brains did as they made these evaluations. When they drank wine from the $90 bottle, there was more activity in the medial orbitofrontal cortex, the MOFC, than when they drank the same wine with a $10 label affixed. The MOFC is a part of the brain whose activity is correlated with pleasure of various kinds, not just tastes, but aromas and music. This experiment suggests that it's also a part of the brain that's influenced by the story you've been told about the pleasure you're feeling, and by the preconceptions this story gives you. The $90 story gets this part of the brain more excited than the $10 story. But there are also parts of the brain that play a role in pleasure and weren't influenced by the wine's price tag. Importantly, wrote the researchers, we did not find evidence for an effect of prices on the primary taste areas, such as the insular cortex, the ventroposterior medial nucleus of the thalamus, or the parabrachial nuclei of the pons. A natural interpretation, they continued, is that the MOFC, the part of the brain that changed in response to the price tag, is where the top-down cognitive processes that encode the flavor expectancies are integrated with the bottom-up sensory components of the wine. In other words, the MOFC seems to be where story, and hence expectation, mixes in with raw sensory data to modulate what the researchers called the hedonic experience of flavor. You might ask if wine drinking is really worth all this study. What does it matter if, as Weber suggests, the story-free consumption of wine is a purer, even pleasanter experience than the more common kind of drinking? Most wine drinkers strike me as pretty happy with the way their wine tastes, however laden it may be with dubious narratives. It's not as if deficient wine drinking is a looming global crisis. But the implications of all this go beyond wine. We're exploring the brain's capacity to create illusions. This particular experiment studied the specific illusion that the intrinsic taste of a beverage depends on the story that has been affixed to it. But that's just one example of a more general illusion, that the essences we sense in things really exist, that they inhabit the things we perceive, when in fact they are constructions of our minds with no necessary correspondence to reality. Things come with stories, and the stories, whether true or false, shape how we feel about the things, and thus shape the things themselves, giving them the full form we perceive. In some contexts, this mental construction of essence can be way, way more consequential than whether wine tastes better with a $90 label than with a $10 label. One such context is when we're attributing essence not to tape measures or houses or any other inanimate object, but to other human beings. That is the subject of the next chapter. 12. A Weedless World. Several days into my first meditation retreat, I was taking a walk in the woods when I encountered an old enemy. Its name is Plantago major, and it is commonly known as the plantain weed. Years earlier, when I lived in Washington, D.C., my lawn had been afflicted by this weed, and I spent many hours battling it, most of them just pulling it out of the ground, but sometimes I got so desperate that I'd use weed killer. I like to think that I'm not the kind of person who would devote much time to loathing forms of foliage, but I have to admit that my attitude toward this plant was in some sense one of hostility. Yet now, on this meditation retreat, I was struck, for the first time ever, by the weed's beauty. Maybe I should be putting the word weed in quotes, because to see a weed as beautiful is to question whether it really should be called a weed. And that is the question I asked myself as I stood there looking at my former foe. Why was this green-leafed thing called a weed, whereas other nearby things that fit the same description weren't? I looked at those nearby things, and then at the weed, and found myself unable to answer the question. There seemed to be no objective visual criteria that distinguished the weeds from non-weeds. In retrospect, I guess I would call this my first close brush with the experience of emptiness. Maybe it wasn't as dramatic, and certainly it wasn't as pervasive and persistent as the experiences described in the previous chapter by Rodney Smith and Gary Weber. But it had the key characteristic of their experience. The weed was projecting its identity less strongly than it traditionally had. Though as visually discernible as ever, it was in some sense less dramatically marked off from the surrounding vegetation than before. It now lacked the essence of weed that had previously made it stand out from the other plants and seem uglier than they seemed. So essence matters. One minute you see a certain essence in something and you want to kill it, and the next minute the essence has vanished and you don't want to kill it. Of course, the stakes aren't all that high here. So far as I know, weeds aren't capable of pleasure or pain, so yanking one out of the ground isn't a grave moral transgression. Still, with weeds, more than with lamps or pencils or eyeglasses, we are approaching the realm of moral psychology, the realm of judgments about good and bad that have consequences for the way we treat other beings. And when the beings in question are sentient, human beings, for example, the stakes can be high. These moral stakes are the main reason I'm spending so much time on the doctrine of emptiness. At the root of the way we treat people, I think, is the essence we see them as having. So it matters whether these perceptions of essence are really true, or whether, as the doctrine of emptiness suggests, they are in some sense illusions. From a Darwinian standpoint, the reason people attribute essence to other people is the same reason they attribute essence to things in general. Fellow human beings, no less than food or tools or predators or shelter, were part of the environment in which we evolved. So natural selection designed us to react to them in particular ways, and it engineered those reactions by giving us feelings toward them, and those feelings give shape to the essence we sense in them. But fellow human beings were a more complicated part of our environment than, say, shelter or tools, and they were a very, very important part. So it stands to reason that we would possess specialized mental machinery for sizing people up and then assigning them an essence. Our essence of person machinery. Decades of social psychology experiments have shed light on how that machinery works. For starters, it works fast. We start sizing people up the moment we first encounter them, and in some cases, we can do a good job on the basis of little evidence. For example, if you show people a short videotape of someone talking or engaging in social interaction, and then ask them to assess something about the person, her professional competence, for example, or her status, the assessments match up pretty well with more objective measurements. That holds true even when there's no audio, so that all the cues are nonverbal. And a judgment rendered after 30 seconds is almost as likely to be accurate as a judgment rendered after 5 minutes. Two Harvard psychologists conducted a meta-analysis of dozens of these thin-slice studies and concluded that, after a very brief observation, some stable underlying essence is picked up by judges. By judges, of course, they meant the people in the experiments who did the observing. But they might as well have been talking about all of us. Judging is what we're designed to do. Our judgments can rest on evidence that may seem laughably superficial. For example, people considered attractive are more likely to be rated as competent. But this makes a certain kind of sense. Attractive people do seem to have an easier time getting their way socially, and being able to pull social levers can be a big part of competence. When it comes to making moral judgments, we don't put so much stock in looks. Attractive people aren't much more likely to be judged as having integrity or being considerate than unattractive people. That too makes sense, since there's no reason to think they are more considerate or conscientious. However, one thing judgments about moral fiber have in common with judgments about competence and status is that we often make them on the basis of a single data point. Though various experiments show this, there's no point in trotting one out. Just reflect on your own behavior. If you see a person stopping to help someone who is lying injured on the sidewalk, don't you think, "Oh, what a nice person"? If you see a person walking briskly past someone lying injured on the sidewalk, don't you think, "Oh, what a not-so-nice person"? I know what you're thinking, but people who stop to help the needy are nice, and people who walk briskly past them aren't nice. Actually, you're wrong. A famous study published in 1973 showed as much. The study was conducted by two Princeton University psychologists, and it involved, for starters, setting up an opportunity for people to be good Samaritans, to help a stranger in need. Here is how the psychologists describe the scene they created. When the subject passed through the alley, the victim was sitting slumped in a doorway, head down, eyes closed, not moving. As the subject went by, the victim coughed twice and groaned, keeping his head down. Some of the experimental subjects stopped to help, and some didn't. If you had been watching all this, you probably would have seen essence of good person in the former and essence of bad person in the latter. But there's actually a different explanation for why some helped and some didn't. The subjects of the experiment were students at Princeton Theological Seminary. They had been told that they had to go give a short impromptu talk in a nearby building. Some had been told they were late for the talk, while others were told they had time to spare. Of the former group, 10% stopped to help, and of the latter group, 63% stopped. So, seeing essence of good person in that 63% is misleading at best. It would be more accurate to see essence of not being in a hurry. Aside from degree of hurriedness, there was only one other variable that the experimenters manipulated. Half of the subjects, before heading over to give their talk, were told to read the Bible story of the Good Samaritan and then give their talk on that. The other half read a passage unrelated to altruism. It turns out that even reflecting on the Good Samaritan didn't increase the chances of being a Good Samaritan. This experiment fits into a large body of psychological literature about something called the fundamental attribution error. The word attribution refers to the tendency to explain people's behavior in terms of either dispositional factors, in other words, the kind of person they are, or situational factors, like whether they happen to be late for a talk. The word error refers to the fact that these attributions are often wrong, that we tend to underestimate the role of situation and overestimate the role of disposition. In other words, we're biased in favor of essence. The term fundamental attribution error was coined in 1977 by the psychologist Lee D. Ross, and its implications can be disorienting. For example, it's common to think of criminals and clergy as being two fundamentally different kinds of people. But Ross and fellow psychologist Richard Nisbet have suggested that we rethink this intuition. As they put it, clerics and criminals rarely face an identical or equivalent set of situational challenges. Rather, they place themselves, and are placed by others, in situations that differ precisely in ways that induce clergy to look, act, feel, and think rather consistently like clergy, and that induce criminals to look, act, feel, and think like criminals. The philosopher Gilbert Harman, after reviewing the literature on the fundamental attribution error, raised questions about the very existence of such character traits as honesty, benevolence, and friendliness. Since it is possible to explain our ordinary belief in character traits as deriving from certain illusions, he wrote, we must conclude that there is no empirical basis for the existence of character traits. This may sound like an extreme view, and certainly many scholars interpret the literature on attribution error less dramatically. Most psychologists who study these things will tell you that some personality traits are, in the average person, fairly stable over time. Still, there is no doubt that our attribution of moral essence to people, seeing them as nice, mean, friendly, unfriendly, does run ahead of the actual evidence. I have more than once seen someone in public behaving so rudely or inconsiderately that I immediately saw him as, and felt him as, bad. And I have more than once, when under great stress, behaved just as rudely and inconsiderately. Yet I did not consider myself bad, at least not essentially bad, even on later reflection. One reason I let myself off the hook is that I understand that the stress caused my bad behavior. It wasn't the real me who did the bad thing. But with other people, I'm less likely to ponder that possibility. That's what the fundamental attribution error is. I attribute their behavior to disposition, not situation. I locate the badness in them, not in environmental factors. Why would the human mind be designed to ignore or downplay situational factors when sizing people up? Well, for starters, remember that natural selection didn't design human minds to size people up accurately. It designed human minds to size people up in a way that would lead to interactions that benefited the genes of the humans doing the sizing up. Consider what, for my money, is one of the more ridiculous kinds of arguments people have. It typically starts with the assertion, "She's a really nice person," or "He's a good guy." Then someone will beg to differ. "No, she's not so nice," or "No, he's actually a bad guy." These arguments can go on forever without either party saying, "Well, maybe she's nice to me, but not nice to you," or "Maybe he's good in the context in which I tend to encounter him, and bad in the context in which you encounter him." From natural selection's point of view, there's no reason for people to give much weight to such a possibility. The possibility that niceness and goodness are largely situational, not dispositional properties. After all, the essence model, the belief that each person has a generally good or a generally bad disposition, works pretty well. If someone is consistently nice to you, it makes sense to get into a relationship of reciprocal niceness. In other words, a friendship. And a belief that the person is essentially good does a fine job of drawing you into that friendship. What's more, this belief will make it easy for you to go around saying that this person is good, which is handy, since speaking highly of a friend is part of the reciprocal altruism that constitutes friendship. Seeing essence of good in your friends lets you discharge this part of the deal effortlessly. It frees you from the nagging awareness that, for all you know, when you're not around, your friends spend their time bilking elderly people. If, on the other hand, someone is consistently mean to you, then seeing essence of bad in him is what leads to optimally self-serving behavior on your part. Not only will you avoid doing favors that would probably go unreciprocated anyway, you'll go around saying, with conviction, that he is a bad person. And it makes sense to say that your enemies are bad people, since the more you can do to undermine their stature, the less they'll be in a position to hurt you. Actually, in the modern world, this may not be such an effective strategy. But in the small hunter-gatherer societies in which humans evolved, persistently bad-mouthing people might indeed have had an appreciable effect on their social standing. It also would have served as a warning to others not to get on your bad side. To summarize, there's one situational variable that always biases our evaluations of people. Every time we see them doing something, they're doing it in our presence, and for all we know, they behave differently around or toward other people. But it makes sense, in a self-serving way, for us to ignore this variable and attribute the behavior we see to their disposition. That way, we'll see them as possessing the essence, good or bad, that's most in our interest to see them possessing. Conveniently, our friends and allies will have essence of good, and our rivals and enemies will have essence of bad. Our essence preservation machinery. But what if reality intrudes on this convenient illusion? What if we do happen to see or hear of an enemy doing something good? And what if we see or hear of a friend doing something bad? Doesn't this threaten to vaporize the essence we've come to see in them? Yes, it does pose that threat. But our brains are very good at fending off threats. In fact, our brains seem to have a mechanism designed to deal with this particular threat. You might call it the essence preservation mechanism. It turns out that the fundamental attribution error, the tendency to overestimate the role of disposition and underestimate the role of situation, isn't quite as simple as psychologists originally thought. Sometimes we actually downplay the role of disposition and amplify the role of situation. There are two kinds of cases in which we tend to do this. 1. If an enemy or rival does something good, we're inclined to attribute it to circumstance. He's just giving money to the beggar to impress a woman who happens to be standing there. 2. If a close friend or ally does something bad, then here too circumstance tends to loom large. She's yelling at a beggar who asks for money because she's been stressed out over her job. This interpretive flexibility shapes not only our personal lives, but international relations. The social scientist Herbert C. Kelman has noted how it keeps enemies on the enemies list. Attribution mechanisms promote confirmation of the original enemy image. Hostile actions by the enemy are attributed dispositionally, and thus provide further evidence of the enemy's inherently aggressive, implacable character. Conciliatory actions are explained away as reactions to situational forces, as tactical maneuvers, responses to external pressure, or temporary adjustments to a position of weakness, and therefore require no revision of the original image. This helps explain why, when wars approach, people who welcome them do their best to demonize the leader of the country they want to go to war with. In the run-up to one of America's two wars with Iraq, the then hawkish American magazine The New Republic put an image of Iraqi President Saddam Hussein on its cover with one embellishment. His mustache was cropped so that it looked like Hitler's. Not very subtle, but effective, because once someone is firmly placed in the enemy box, our attribution mechanisms make escaping the box very hard. If, for example, someone like Hussein lets international inspectors into his country to look for weapons of mass destruction, which he did shortly before the Iraq War of 2003, it must be a trick. He must be hiding those weapons of mass destruction somewhere. After all, Hussein has essence of bad, if not essence of evil. And to be sure, Hussein had done horrible things. But failing to think clearly about him led to more horrible things, the death of well over 100,000 innocent people in the Iraq War and its aftermath. War offers a good example of how essence can spread from one level to another. You start out with the idea that a nation's leader is essentially bad. From this, you move to the idea that an entire nation, the nation of Iraq, or Germany, or Japan, is your enemy. This then translates into the idea that all the soldiers of that country, or even all the people in that country, are essentially bad. And if people are bad, that means you can kill them without feeling the sting of conscience. The United States dropped atomic bombs on two Japanese cities. Cities, not military bases. And drew virtually no protest from Americans. Happily, most of us haven't been swept up in tribal psychology with such lethal consequence, but less weighty instances of this psychology, altering our perception and moral calculus, are common. A particularly telling example occurred in 1951, only a mile east of the Princeton Theological Seminary, site of that 1973 Good Samaritan experiment. The essence of opposition. The place was Palmer Stadium, and the occasion was a football game between Princeton and Dartmouth. This was back in the days when Ivy League football was world-class football. The week before the game, Princeton's All-American tailback, Dick Kazmaier, had appeared on the cover of Time magazine. The game was rough, and by some accounts, dirty. Kazmaier had his nose broken in the second quarter, and in the third quarter, a Dartmouth player left the game with a broken leg. Two psychology professors, Hadley Cantrill of Princeton and Albert Hastorf of Dartmouth, later wrote, "Tempers flared both during and after the game. Accusations soon began to fly." Hastorf and Cantrill turned the occasion into a study of tribal psychology. They showed films of the game to Princeton students and Dartmouth students and found sharp differences of perspective. For example, while Princeton students, on average, saw Dartmouth commit 9.8 infractions of the rules. Dartmouth students, on average, saw 4.3 Dartmouth infractions. These findings may not shock you. The tribal affiliation can skew perception is common knowledge. But this study took a real-world example of this bias and carried it from the realm of anecdote into the realm of data. That's how it became a classic. What's less known than the study's famous quantification of bias is that the authors raised questions about whether bias was really the right word. When we think of a cognitive bias, we think of a distortion of what would otherwise be a clear view of the thing perceived. But that presupposes that there is a thing being perceived. Hastorf and Cantrell wrote, "It is inaccurate and misleading to say that different people have different attitudes concerning the same thing. The data here indicate that there is no such thing as a game existing out there, in its own right, which people merely observe. The game exists for a person and is experienced by him only insofar as certain happenings have significances in terms of his purpose. Out of all the occurrences going on in the environment, a person selects those that have some significance for him from his own egocentric position in the total matrix." Hastorf and Cantrell weren't talking about the movie, The Matrix, of course. But like the movie, they were raising doubts about how real reality is, about whether it makes sense to talk about things existing out there, independent of the minds that conceive them. They wrote, "For the thing simply is not the same for different people, whether the thing is a football game, a presidential candidate, communism, or spinach." All this reminds me of a conversation I had with Lita Cosmides, whom we met in Chapter 7, and who did much to develop the modular view of the mind. Actually, she no longer calls it the modular view. The term modules, she says, has come to be misunderstood, in part because some of the misconceptions about it that I tried to dispel in Chapter 7 haven't been widely dispelled. She now uses other terminology, such as the more precise, if considerably less elegant, domain-specific psychological mechanisms. Lita and I were discussing the relationship between these modules and the various biases that afflict human apprehension of the world. Earlier in the conversation, I talked about how our view of the world can be colored by whichever module is dominating our consciousness at that moment. She questioned whether it made sense to talk about a process of coloration, as if there was some uncolored view that had existed before the color was applied. "There's always some psychological mechanism doing something," she said. "It's creating our world. It's creating our perception of the world. That's why I wouldn't say domain-specific mechanisms color our perceptions. I'd say they create our perceptions. There's no way of perceiving the world that doesn't involve carving it conceptually into pieces." This sounds quite like the view from Buddhism. Everything, from spinach to football games, is empty of inherent existence. Things, forms, come into existence in our consciousness only after we have taken some combination of elements in our perceptual field and imposed a collective meaning on them. Hastorf and Cantrell wrote, "An occurrence on the football field, or in any other social situation, does not become an experiential event unless and until some significance is given to it." And this significance, they said, comes from a kind of database of significances, a database that resides in what we have called a person's assumptive form world. Until those significances are assigned, presumably, the world is in some sense formless. But once they are assigned, there is form, there is essence. In fact, there are essences within essences. There is essence of football game, essence of football team, essence of football player. And these different essences can inform one another. The specific essence that a particular football game has will depend on the essences of the two teams. For example, which team we like, and how much we like it, and the way in which we like it. And this will in turn inform the essences of the players. Or maybe things will work the other way around, and the essence we see in a particular football player will determine which team we favor, which will in turn shape the form the game assumes in our memory. No doubt, somewhere in America in 1951, some kid who had never heard of Princeton read the Time magazine cover story about Dick Kazmaier and became a Princeton fan, and all subsequent news about Princeton football games was folded into the appropriate form. I'm not saying, and I don't think Hasdorf and Cantrell were saying, that if you don't have a preferred football team, then the world of football is for you a world without form. If you're walking through an airport and look up and see a football game on TV, you perceive a kind of generic essence of football game before you even know what teams are playing. But even though you don't have a team preference, you may notice, on close inspection, that this generic sense of essence does in fact involve a kind of preference. Though you're not a fan of either team, you may be a football fan, and thus drawn into closer engagement with the game, curious to see who is playing, or just eager to see some interesting plays. If, on the other hand, you're not a football fan, the essence you perceive will not be enthralling, and may even be off-putting, however mildly. This is the reminder that specifically tribal psychology is in one sense not all that different from psychology generally. We go through each day attaching positive and negative tags to things we see. Being affiliated with a tribe, a football team, a nation, an ethnic group, is a particular instance of that tendency, and sometimes a particularly intense instance of it. Our tribe can be very good, and its enemies very bad. At the same time, it would be misleading to act as if tribal psychology is just regular psychology with the volume turned up. Natural selection designed parts of the human mind specifically to steer us through conflicts, conflicts between individuals and conflicts between groups. Some of our mental machinery is exquisitely geared to that function, including the essence preservation machinery that makes our enemies more readily blameworthy for bad behavior than our allies, and makes it easy to witness the suffering of our enemies with indifference. In fact, satisfaction is more like it than indifference. One piece of moral equipment natural selection implanted in our brains is a sense of justice, the intuition that good deeds should be rewarded and bad deeds should be punished. So seeing evildoers suffer can give us the gratifying sense that justice has been done. And conveniently, it's our enemies and rivals who typically are guilty of doing bad things. When our friends and allies do them, they are likely just victims of circumstance, and so not deserving of harsh punishment. Unless, perhaps, they do bad things to us, which may be cause to start moving them out of the friends and allies category. My brief flirtation with loving an enemy. All of which brings us back to the plantain weed. Though my long history of opposition to, even enmity toward, the plantain weed did have a kind of moral aura surrounding it, I wasn't deploying nearly all the moral weaponry I'm capable of deploying. The really heavy-duty weaponry is reserved for human beings. And yet the line across which the weaponry is deployed, the line between good humans and bad humans, is often no less arbitrary than the line separating weeds from other plants. There is a meditative technique specifically designed to blur this line. It's called loving-kindness meditation, or, to use the ancient Pali word for loving-kindness, metta meditation. Typically, the meditation starts with you making a point of feeling kindly toward yourself. Then you imagine someone you love and direct some loving kindness toward him or her. Then you imagine someone you like and direct some loving kindness toward that person. Then you think about someone you don't feel strongly about one way or the other, and so on, until you get to an actual enemy. If all goes according to plan, you manage to feel loving kindness, even for that enemy. It seems only appropriate to say a few kind words about loving kindness meditation, so here they are. It works for some people, but it doesn't work for me.